I'm going to go ahead and get started.
Okay.
Thanks to everybody who came out on the holiday weekend. I knew we were going to have a thinner turnout, but the next 2 weeks we're probably going to end up not having class because of Symphony Sunday and the church picnic.
Yep.
Yeah, so I figured... I saw a lot of you in church this morning, so I said, we'll go ahead and have class tonight. So when we last left off, King Solomon had died, and his kingdom, due to the way he had lived his life with his 700 wives and 300 concubines, the way he run his family, and the way he had chosen to build temples for the false pagan gods of his wives and participate in their worship.
Question: when he had these wives and concubines, when he dies, what happens to these women? I mean,
well,
is the next guy coming in? Does he inherit them?
Essentially, whoever takes over is supposed to take care of them. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So, now we're going to see that doesn't always happen. And sometimes we've seen a couple times already, right, where they kind of got used as bargaining chips. Like when Absalom was trying to take over for David and he went and slept with some of his father's concubines to try and claim the throne. So, things don't always go well. And if they have a son who might try and claim the throne from whoever the king is, things don't go so well for them then either sometimes. But... because of all these things Solomon had done, God's judgment against him is that 10 of the tribes of Israel get taken away from him. And so his son, Rehoboam, who becomes king after him, is the king of one tribe. Now 10 and 1 is 11. What happened to the other tribe? The other tribe is the Levites. All right, remember, they don't have land.
They're supposed to do all the
they're supposed stuff. Yeah, right. They're serving. In theory, they're serving at the tabernacle, and now they're serving at the temple. We've seen they're actually doing all kinds of things all over the place, involving other gods as well. But so Rehoboam was left with this one tribe, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who is one of Solomon's officials, part of the government bureaucracy. A prophet comes to him and tells him he's going to be the first king of this new nation of Israel, made up of the other 10 tribes. And God makes the same promise to him, we talked about last time, that he made to David. If you follow all my ways and walk in all my commandments, I will make your dynasty eternal. One of your children will always reign on the throne. We're going to see how that goes. We've already started to see how that goes. If you have the, does everybody have a copy of the new map? Okay. Now, when you're looking at this map, when you look at modern maps, you expect to see lines drawn between countries. With a couple exceptions, you'll notice here that there aren't any. Okay. And the reason for that is you have to remember the time period in history that we're in. We're in the early 800s BC. Okay. And as we've seen, the whole idea of a country or a nation is sort of coming into existence right now. So remember, originally each of these cities would have been independent. It would have been its own independent city with its own independent king. And then what happened was certain cities with certain kings became more powerful. And so they made the other surrounding cities essentially what are called vassals, meaning they said, we control the chips here, we've got the bigger military, we've got more force, so you're going to pay us tribute. Right? And so they then had would have several vassal cities around their main city. And then since the next step that we've gotten to now is that that big city has now become sort of a capital city. And the other cities have become the other cities of a country. But countries are still very much made up of these cities. Okay. So they're not made up of a certain square footage of territory. They're made up of cities. So there are cities that are cities of the Phoenicians, right? Like we can see up there, Phoenicia, the northern part there on the coast, Tyre and Sidon and Zarephath, right? Those are Phoenician cities. Where exactly does Phoenicia end and Israel begin up there in Galilee? It's a trick question. It doesn't really, right? There are cities that are cities of Galilee, and there are cities that are cities of Phoenicia. Who owns the land in between? Well, nobody really. There's nothing there. Right? It's undeveloped land. If someone went and built a city there, that city would then have to be either independent or join with the Phoenicians or join with Israel. Okay. Now, where they did draw lines down here, they drew the border between Judah and Israel. And the reason they did that down here at the bottom is, as you can see, there are a whole bunch of cities that are real close together. So they drew that line in there so you'd be clear that, for example, Bethel, see, is part of Israel. It's just north of the line. Whereas Mizpah, which is a stone's throw from Bethel, but is south of the line, that's one of the cities of Judah. That's why that line's there. But we shouldn't think of that line as a border the way we think of borders between countries today. Okay, it's really just cities. And that's why, remember, Solomon is sort of a thank you gift to Hiram. Hiram, the king of Tyre, was the king of the Phoenicians, right? He helped Solomon build his palace and his temple. And so in response, Solomon gave him a bunch of cities in Galilee.
Yeah.
Right? He just took those cities up here and said, okay, those are no longer cities in Israel, my kingdom. Those are now Phoenician cities. Okay. He didn't hand off a certain square footage of territory. It was cities.
Okay. Because outside the cities, you had your land that you did your sheep.
Right around the city.
Out here, they just really didn't care about it because they couldn't get no use out of it.
Right, it was undeveloped.
Undeveloped land.
And nomads would live on it or
whoever. But they didn't claim it.
Wild animals, yeah.
Okay.
So now, the thing to note, remember right at the end last time, Jeroboam, after he became king of this northern kingdom, he sensed a problem. He said, well, if people worship Yahweh the way they're supposed to, right, the Ark of the Covenant is now in this temple in Jerusalem. Well, Jerusalem is in this other kingdom. Right? So if my people are always making pilgrimages down to Jerusalem, this other guy's territory to worship, okay, that's going to it's going to undermine my authority, and eventually they may decide that they want to become part of Judah again. So he decides that to help secure his own throne, he's going to set up his own religion.
Wait a minute. Tell him not to do that.
Oh, yeah.
He's going wrong right off the bat. Yeah.
So he decided. Now, and it's important to note, he doesn't just create a new religion out of whole cloth. He doesn't just go and pick one of the religions. Like, he doesn't take the Phoenician religion. He doesn't say, okay, we're going to worship Baal like the Phoenicians do. What he does is, he says, okay, we're going to worship Yahweh still, because that's who everybody, all my people worship, right? We don't want to shock their system too much here. We're going to worship Yahweh still, but we're going to do it differently. And the way he set up to do it was a way that was familiar to them. Okay. So the first thing he did was he built two golden calves with altars, one at Bethel, right? We just saw that's just barely north of the line. Right there on the very southern end of his kingdom. And the other one is at Dan, which is all the way up here in Galilee, all the way up at the top. Right? So he builds one at each end, all the way at the northern end and all the way at the southern end. So if you live toward the northern part of his kingdom, you can go up to Dan and worship. If you live in the southern part of his kingdom, you can go down to Bethel and worship. But either way, you don't have to go to Jerusalem. You don't have to leave his kingdom. Okay? And then on top of that, He sets up high places, like the places where they worshiped Baal and these other gods, all through his kingdom. And he even creates his own feast days and holidays. So what he's basically saying to them is, we're going to keep worshiping Yahweh, but we'll do it in a way that appeals to you. Right? The way you're used to worshiping these other pagan gods. A contemporary, contemporary worship. And we'll do it right. We'll do it right here. Okay. So that's what he had just set up. But now obviously this bodes ill in terms of how he's gonna go. But I said last time too that Jeroboam son of Nebat, this person here, is very important in the Old Testament for this reason. He's the one who establishes this northern kingdom of Israel and who creates this false religion. And we're going to see what happens to it. But it's going to continue now for a few centuries. Okay, and in certain ways, it's going to continue even past that. We're going to see that, and Scripture is going to refer to him a lot. Not as a good example, but he's going to be referred to. Okay. So that brings us to where we left off last time, the beginning of chapter 13. Chapter 13, verse 1. By the word of the Lord, a man of God came from Judah to Bethel as Jeroboam was standing by the altar to make an offering. Okay. So, two things to notice here. One, there's not a priest making the offering. Notice, Jeroboam the king is doing it himself. So even in that way, he's doing it pagan style. Right? The king comes and does the sacrifice. Okay? As man of God is a prophet. He's one of God's prophets. I talked about right at the end last time that we're going to see as sort of the institutional religion and the institutions of government start going to pot. God starts sending people from outside to come and try to straighten them out, try to warn them. This is another example of this. So he's standing there, he's getting ready to make his sacrifice by his golden calf in Bethel, and this prophet shows up. He cried out against the altar by the word of the Lord, O altar, altar, this is what the Lord says. A son named Josiah will be born to the house of David. On you he will sacrifice the priests of the high places who now make offerings here, and human bones will be burned on you. So, first he says, a son will be born to it, meaning a king from this line. Not this line. King from this line. Right? Is going to come and use these altars, but he's going to use them to kill the priests who are practicing this false religion. Okay? So, on one hand, God's saying, this false religion is a no-go. On the other, and he's also saying that it's going to be put down by a king from over here, meaning that doesn't bode well for Jeroboam, right? In terms of him and his family line staying king. Okay.
Verse 3, that same day the man of God gave a sign. This is the sign the Lord has declared. The altar will be split apart and the ashes on it will be poured out.
This is something we're going to see with the prophets. We've already seen it a couple of times, but where the prophet is going to show up and he's going to make some pronouncement about something that's going to happen in the future. And then in addition to making that promise about what's going to happen in the future, he says he'll give a sign, meaning he'll do something right then. And he'll say, here's how you know I'm telling the truth about what's going to happen in the future. Watch this happen. Right? Watch this happen. And this is part of what's behind when we get to the New Testament. And when we read over and over again, it'll say the Jews came to Jesus to ask him for a sign. That's what this is referring to. Jesus is coming and preaching and teaching, and they're like, well, show us some sign that what you're saying is true. Right? Basically, do a miracle for us. Right? So we know this is true. And Jesus continues, he gives them a variety of answers, you know, a lot of them being, he's done a whole lot of signs already, if you didn't notice. You missed all those other ones. At one point, he says, you'll have no sign of the sign of Jonah. We'll get to the book of Jonah later. But the idea is that Jesus is going to essentially say that he doesn't have anything to prove. Right? He doesn't have to prove his authority. Well, there are so many people going around calling themselves prophets in this day and age. Like we saw Balaam, who was a prophet for a pagan god back in Numbers. There's so many people going around calling themselves prophets that you have to offer some kind of credentials for them to know, you know, who is this guy who just showed up claiming he speaks for God? Give us a proof. So they'll normally give some sign like this that you'll see in the short term so that you'll know that their long-term prophecy is true. And remember in Deuteronomy, God told the people they were supposed to test people who showed up and claimed they were prophets.
Yeah.
Right? If you show up and claim they're a prophet, and then what you say doesn't come true, they're supposed to be put to death, because that means they're a false prophet, they're lying. They're claiming to speak for God, and they're not. Right? Okay, so he says, here's how you're going to know that this is true about this descendant of David. It's judged by your religion. This altar is going to crack in half, and all the ashes on it from the animals you've been burning are going to spill out all over the ground. Okay. Verse 4, when King Jeroboam heard what the man of God cried out against the altar at Bethel, he stretched out his hand from the altar and said, seize him. But the hand he stretched out toward the man shriveled up so that he could not pull it back. Also, the altar was split apart and its ashes poured out according to the sign given by the man of God by the word of the Lord. So you get a twofer here on signs. Number one, Jeroboam says, seize him, and his arm withers. So that he can't even pull it back. Right? And then the altar splits in two. Now this is a pretty bad sign if you're Jeroboam. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And now Jeroboam responds in a fairly sensible way. Verse 6, then the king said to the man of God, intercede with the Lord your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored. So he says, whoops! Okay, clearly this is a real legit prophet. So he asked him to pray for him. So the man of God interceded with the Lord, and the king's hand was restored and became as it was before. The king said to the man of God, come home with me and have something to eat, and I will give you a gift. But the man of God answered the king, even if you were to give me half your possessions, I would not go with you, nor would I eat bread or drink water here. For I was commanded by the word of the Lord, you must not eat bread or drink water or return by the way you came. So he took another road and did not return by the way he had come to Bethel. Okay. So, Jeroboam's response is, well, okay, this guy's God's representative. God's clearly angry at me. I better make nice. Right? So he said, well, go out to the palace. We'll have a good time. Right? Give you some gifts. But God told this prophet essentially to have nothing to do with him. Right? To go deliver the message
and leave.
Leave and go home by a different route so that nobody could track him down.
He invited the Lord.
Well,
he left.
So far. So verse 11, now there was a certain old prophet living in Bethel whose sons came and told him all that the man of God had done there that day. They also told their father what he had said to the king. Their father asked them, which way did he go? And his son showed him which road the man of God from Judah had taken. So he said to his son, saddle the donkey for me. When they had saddled the donkey for him, he mounted it and rode after the man of God. He found him sitting under an oak tree and asked, are you the man of God who came from Judah? I am, he replied. So the prophet said to him, come home with me and eat. So this old prophet in Bethel, who's living there with his sons, the idea we're given here, since he lives in Bethel, right, is that he apparently has no real problem with what Jeroboam's doing, right? Unlike this other prophet who had to show up. Because if he was a real prophet, he would have been the one standing there saying to Jeroboam, right? So he's clearly either on Jeroboam's side or just doesn't care. Okay, well, he hears what happened. He hears that this prophet came and pronounced this judgment against Jeroboam. And then he took off and wouldn't accept Jeroboam's hospitality. So he rides out. Why would he ride off after him? Why would he try and find him?
And he wants
No, I think it's because he wants him to take it back. I think it's because this prophet is pro-Jeroboam. This is one of Jeroboam's prophets, and he wants this other prophet to take it back, the way the king did, right? The king's like, come to my house, you know, to see I'm not such a bad guy. Take that back, right? The judgment. I think he wants the same thing. So he goes, he finds him, he's sitting under a tree, he's making this long journey home. Asks him if he's the prophet. He says, yeah. So he says, come home and eat with me. Verse 16, the man of God said, I cannot turn back and go with you, nor can I eat bread or drink water with you in this place. I have been told by the word of the Lord, you must not eat bread or drink water there or return by the way you came. The old prophet answered, I too am a prophet as you are. And an angel said to me by the word of the Lord, bring him back with you to your house so that he may eat bread and drink water. But he was lying to him. So the man of God returned with him and ate and drank in his house. So when he says, come eat with me, he says, oh, I can't. God told me not to. He says, well, funny you should say that. Right? Because an angel appeared to me and told me you should come eat at my house.
Well, how come he didn't test him there on the spot?
And that is the point. He just accepts this.
Oops. And goes back.
This person shows up claiming to be a prophet, right? Mm-hmm. Claiming he received this message from God. This is the exact opposite of the message that he knows he received from God. And he just kind of says, oh, okay then. Right? And goes and eats with them. So how do you think this is going to turn out for the prophet? Verse 20, while they were sitting at the table, the word of the Lord came to the old prophet who had brought him back. He cried out to the man of God who had come from Judah, this is what the Lord says. You have defied the word of the Lord and have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. You came back and ate bread and drank water in the place where he told you not to eat or drink. Therefore your body will not be buried in the tomb of your fathers. So to prove that God has a sense of irony, right? It's the old prophet who now actually gets the message from God, which condemns
the new prophet.
Which condemns the man of God from Judah and says, you did exactly what I told you not to do, and so as punishment you're not going to be buried in the tomb of your fathers, meaning you're not going to get to go back home. Is what that means. When the man of God had finished eating and drinking, the prophet who had brought him back saddled his donkey for him. As he went on his way, a lion met him on the road and killed him. And his body was thrown down on the road, with both the donkey and the lion standing beside it. So people who passed by saw the body thrown down there with the lion standing beside the body. And they went and reported it in the city where the old prophet lived. When the prophet who had brought him back from his journey heard of it, he said, "It is the man of God who defied the word of the Lord. The Lord has given him over to the lion, which has mauled him and killed him, as the word of the Lord had warned him." The prophet said to his son, "Saddle the donkey for me," and they did so. And he went out and found the body thrown down on the road with the donkey and the lion standing beside it. The lion had neither eaten the body nor mauled the donkey. Right, so this in and of itself is a fairly miraculous occurrence. Okay, the lion comes and kills him, but
doesn't
eat him or do anything with the body, and it doesn't even go after his donkey. It just sort of stands there and guards the body. So the prophet picked up the body of the man of God, laid it on the donkey, and brought it back to his own city to mourn for him and bury him. Then he laid the body in his own tomb, and they mourned over him and said, "Oh, my brother." After burying him, he said to his sons, "When I die, bury me in the grave where the man of God is buried. Lay my bones beside his bones. For the message he declared by the word of the Lord against the altar in Bethel and against all the shrines and the high places in the towns of Samaria will certainly come true." So why is this kind of weird story in here? Well, it's to point out that he goes to try and get the first prophet because he wants him to take back the judgment. What ends up happening is that judgment ends up being confirmed. Right? If God is this serious about this message he gives not to eat and drink, how much more serious is he about what Jeroboam is doing? Right? And so even, and secondarily, even if his prophet isn't obeying him, whether it's the old prophet or whether it's the other man of God, God's message that he sends is still true. So all this happens to sort of confirm to Jeroboam this judgment that's upon him for what he's doing by setting up these golden calves and setting up this false religion. But in verse 33, even after this, Jeroboam did not change his evil ways, but once more appointed priests for the high places from all sorts of people. That all sorts of people means he's not even using Levites. Like, he's not even that close. It's not even just that he's having the Levites do these things. He's just picking whoever. So he has no regard for what God has said about religious practice at all. Anyone who wanted to become a priest, he consecrated for the high places. This was the sin of the house of Jeroboam that led to its downfall and to its destruction from the face of the earth. Well, there's a little bit of a spoiler telling you what's going to happen now. That not only does it bring about its downfall, but this idea that, remember we talked about how your descendants, this is before we have sort of a full-fledged idea of the afterlife, and so people's descendants, that was sort of their life after death, was the idea that their family name, their descendants would live on in the land. And especially if you were a king, that's why this promise that comes first to David and then these other kings is so important, that someone from your flesh, your sons, is not only going to live, but is going to rule, is going to sit on the throne. That's why that's such a powerful promise, this idea. Well, this is the opposite of that promise. This is, your name is going to be obliterated from the earth. There's going to be nobody descended from Jeroboam. There's going to be no throne of Jeroboam. It's just going to be gone. Chapter 14, verse 1. At that time, Abijah, son of Jeroboam, became ill. And Jeroboam said to his wife, "Go disguise yourself so you won't be recognized as the wife of Jeroboam. Then go to Shiloh. Ahijah the prophet is there, the one who told me I would be king over this people. Take 10 loaves of bread with you, some cakes and a jar of honey, and go to him. He will tell you what will happen to the boy." So Jeroboam's wife did what he said and went to Ahijah's house in Shiloh. Now why would she disguise herself? Because Shiloh is in the southern kingdom. Okay. So remember Ahijah, this is the prophet who came to Jeroboam in the first place and said, because of what Solomon did, 10 tribes are being taken away from him and you're going to be king over them. Okay. Now his son, who's the one set to inherit the throne, gets sick. Right? He says, well, I know that prophet is a real prophet because look, I'm king. So it came true. Right? So go disguise yourself so they don't know you're my wife. Go down to Judah. Go down to Shiloh and find him and ask him what's going to happen to our son. Now Ahijah could not see. His sight was gone because of his age. But the Lord had told Ahijah, "Jeroboam's wife is coming to ask you about her son, for he is ill. And you are to give her such and such an answer. When she arrives, she will pretend to be someone else." So when Ahijah heard the sound of her footsteps at the door, he said, "Come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why this pretense? I have been sent to you with bad news." So she just walks up to come in disguise, and he says, "How you doing, Jeroboam's wife? What's with the disguise? I've got bad news for you." He says, "Go tell Jeroboam that this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I raised you up from among the people and made you a leader over my people Israel. I tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you. But you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commands and followed me with all his heart, doing only what was right in my eyes. You have done more evil than all who lived before you. You have made for yourselves other gods, idols made of metal. You have provoked me to anger and thrust me behind your back." Notice a couple things here. He identifies himself as the God of Israel. And he refers to the people of Israel as who he put him over as my people. Couple things that are important there. Number one, when he took those 10 tribes away from Solomon, he was not rejecting them. This is not a case where God said, "These are my favorites. Forget about these guys."
He didn't right? forget.
He says, these are my people too. These are my people too. I put you in charge of my people, Jeroboam. And this is what you do. This is what you did with the position I gave you, with the power I gave you over my people. Okay, whose God I am. Okay. And this reference to, you thrust me behind your back. What does that mean? Well, that doesn't really mean ignoring him. The picture is that as if Jeroboam's standing in front of the people, right? God has given the people everything they have, right? He's given them the land, he's given them the prosperity, he's given them the food, he's given them rain. And Jeroboam keeps shoving him behind his back so that he'll get the credit and the applause. Okay. So he says, I put you in this position. I give you this power and this authority over my people. And you essentially try to steal them from me. They're not your people. They're my people. Verse 10, because of this, I'm going to bring disaster on the house of Jeroboam. I will cut off from Jeroboam every last male in Israel, slave or free. I will burn up the house of Jeroboam as one burns dung until it is all gone. Dogs will eat those belonging to Jeroboam who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. The Lord has spoken. Okay. Pretty harsh. Comparing his house to dung. Right? And saying, not only am I going to wipe out your family, but no one's going to bury them. There's going to be no one left to bury them. Dogs are going to eat the ones who die in the city. Birds are going to eat the ones who die in the country. He talked about how that the shame of that, the idea that someone dies and there's no one who cares for them enough to even bury them. Okay. So he says, look, you remember the promise I made to you? Well, I said, if you do this and this, then you're preserved forever. Well, you did the exact opposite. So now you're under those curses. Same curses for back in Deuteronomy. Right, you went the other way, and now this is going to be the result. Verse 12, as for you, meaning his wife, go back home. When you set foot in your city, the boy will die. All Israel will mourn for him and bury him. He is the only one belonging to Jeroboam who will be buried, because he is the only one in the house of Jeroboam in whom the Lord, the God of Israel, has found anything good. Okay. So remember, this son is named Abijah. Abijah means my father is Yahweh. That's what that Jah is on the end. Okay. The interesting thing about that meaning, if his father is Yahweh, his father isn't Jeroboam. So his son, at least, seems to be innocent. Okay. And so because of that, the reward is he's still going to die because of what his father's done, but he's going to be buried and he's going to be mourned. He's not going to be under this curse that Jeroboam's brought on the rest of his household. But again here, like we saw back in the stories of Sodom and Gomorrah, as we've seen over and over again, God doesn't punish innocent people with the guilty. We got to remember, when we read these things, that judgment is falling on this person's household and their sons are dying. The sons who are dying aren't these innocent people who have never done anything wrong in their life. Okay. When there's a situation like that, where there's a son who's different, we see right here how God deals with it. Right? He deals with them as a different individual. So we can only assume from this that the rest of Jeroboam's household is right on the same page Jeroboam is. They're right there with him. And so they're going to have the same consequences. Verse 14, the Lord will raise up for himself a king over Israel who will cut off the family of Jeroboam. This is the day. What? Yes, even now. And the Lord will strike Israel so that it will be like a reed swaying in the water. He will uproot Israel from this good land that he gave to their forefathers and scatter them beyond the river because they provoked the Lord to anger by making Asherah poles. And he will give Israel up because of the sins Jeroboam has committed and has caused Israel to commit. So now, this is going a little further. We're going a little further into the future too. First, just like God raised up Jeroboam and made him king, he's saying, I could raise up somebody else. It's not even hard, right? I'll put someone else in charge of my people as king. Okay, but he's also, this prophecy is going forward into the future, that this isn't going to be an isolated incident. That this is going to continue, and there's going to be more judgment, not just for this one man's house, but for the whole nation. This is the first prediction that the nation of Israel is going to end up in exile beyond the river, referring to the Euphrates River, meaning, in this case, in Assyria. Yeah. So, sort of an all-encompassing Jeroboam. And so, this actually has that twofold character. Remember, something's going to happen right now that you're going to see. Jeroboam and his family are going to be gone, and there's going to be a new king in his place. And that's going to let you know that in the future, there's this judgment waiting for the whole nation if they don't repent, if they don't come around and change, which we're going to see isn't going to happen. So in verse 17, after hearing this pronouncement, Jeroboam's wife got up and left and went to Tirzah. As soon as she stepped over the threshold of the house, the boy died. They buried him, and all Israel mourned for him, as the Lord had said through his servant, the prophet Ahijah. The other events of Jeroboam's reign, his wars, and how he ruled are written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel. He reigned for 22 years and then rested with his fathers, and Nadab, his son, succeeded him as king. So, remember, I talked about last time how this is going to become sort of a refrain. In terms of all the other stuff Jeroboam did, the wars he fought, the laws he passed, all those things, you can read about that in the official records, right? You can read about that in the history books. As far as God is concerned, here's what's important about it. The evil he did.
He didn't follow God.
And the fact that because of that, he's going to be cut off. We're going to see that again and again here now as we go through these succession of kings, where it's going to sort of say, we're going to find out a few details that from God's perspective are important about the king, and it's going to say, as for all the rest of the stuff he did, you can go read a history book, right? And in some cases, history books have a lot to say about these people. We're going to get to one, we may even get to him tonight, named Omri, who fills books with all of his exploits in terms of historically, and the wars he fought, the way his territorial expansions, and he's incredibly famous. He's probably, after Solomon, had the biggest kingdom of any of these kings. And there's about three verses about him
in the Bible,
basically telling us he was wicked and he bought a hill. and that's it. That's it. Books and books of history about him. And God says, if you want to know more about him, go ahead and read those books.
But the Lord didn't like him all.
If you're like Father Stephen and you're a history nerd, go read those books. Have a blast, but this is, as far as God's concerned, this is all that's important. He was wicked. So he ends up being king for 22 years. Remember how long Solomon was king? 40 years. And David ended up being 40 years, all totaled, once you piece together the repairs of his king. Considerably less. More than half, but not much more than half. And then his son Nadab becomes king of Israel. In verse 21, now we shift back over to Judah. What's going on in Judah while this is happening? Rehoboam, son of Solomon, was king in Judah. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name. His mother's name was Naamah. She was an Ammonite. So he only gets 17.
You notice he keeps cutting them down.
Oh, it's going to get a lot shorter than that before we're through. Now, we're going to notice something. And there are going to be additional importances. But the kings of Judah, remember what one of the first things Solomon did when he became king was that he set up another throne on the right hand of his for his mother, Bathsheba, right? She was the queen mother. Okay? You're going to notice when we talk about the kings of Judah, it's always going to say who their mother was. Okay? And that's because in Judah, there was this office of queen mother. You may have noticed we haven't heard any references to queens at this point in either kingdom, but out of Judah. Like, David had a bunch of wives. Which one was his queen? There isn't really anybody reigning as queen. Which one of those 1,000 women was Solomon's queen? There wasn't one. The person who's operating the way we would understand a queen is the king's mother. Okay. So out of those 1,000 wives, the one who ends up being queen is this Naamah, who's Rehoboam's mother, because her son becomes king. Okay? And here, just to remind us about what daddy was like, Naamah was an Ammonite, not an Israelite. Okay? So we're gonna have the name of the mother, and we're gonna find out a little bit more about this queen mother job. But this is something important. You won't hear a lot of commentary in Protestant commentaries on these books about this office. And the reason for that is that it has a very obvious New Testament application if Jesus is the Messiah. If Jesus is the Messiah, if he's the king from David's line, right, who comes now to reign over Israel, then his mother has an important position. That makes his mother the queen. Right? And so if you read Protestant commentaries on the second king, they will gloss over this. Okay, but this is an office in Judah. We're going to see it going forward. It's going to be referred to as an office. Okay. So the expectation that any Jewish person would have is that the Messiah's mother is going to be the queen, in the same way that the Messiah is the king. Okay? Not because they're going to be married, but because it's the mother of the Davidic king who functions in that office. That's why we have the icon of the Theotokos on the right side of the icon of Christ. Right. And even when she's holding him, she's on the
right side. She's always right.
Let's go back to this. And we'll continue. We'll see that tonight several more times. This is going to be referred to. Okay. So verse 22, Judah did evil in the eyes of the Lord. By the sins they committed, they stirred up his jealous anger more than their fathers had done. Who are their fathers in this case? Not only the people they're descended from, but Solomon. Okay, so lest you think this is like the bad child and the good child, they're both. Neither one of them is following God at this point. They also set up for themselves high places, sacred stones, and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. That's probably a slight exaggeration, but you get the point. Every hill they could find, they set up a pagan shrine. Every grove of trees, they went and set up a pagan shrine. Every single one. There were even male shrine prostitutes in the land. The people engaged in all the detestable practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. This is seen as sort of a step forward in paganism, a step backward for Israel. That now not only do they have female prostitutes operating at these shrines, they now also have male prostitutes operating at these shrines, engaging in these essentially orgies to guarantee fertility of crops and this sort of thing. Okay. So there are men of Israel volunteering for this duty.
Okay, and this is a sign of just how far they've gone off the rails. Okay. So in verse 25, in the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem. This is the one we talked about last time, who became Pharaoh, started the 29th dynasty in Egypt while Solomon was still reigning. His name in Egyptian is Shoshak. Okay. Comes to attack Jerusalem. He carried off the treasures of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including all the gold shields Solomon had made. Okay. So he comes in, carries everything off. So this tells you this wasn't just there was a war or there was a raid. He pillaged the king's house. He pillaged the temple. All that great, cool, gold stuff we read about being built just a couple of weeks ago, right?
No.
He takes it all. He steals it all. Okay, and there's apparently nothing Rehoboam could do about it. Okay? So there's two things there. Number one, there's some judgment against Rehoboam, because remember, one of the signs that you have God's favor is you're victorious in battle. Well, this is about as non-victorious as you can get. Right? Number one. Number two, this shows right off the bat. Later on, we're going to see that there's going to be a certain group of people in Judah who are going to think that they can't be conquered because God wouldn't let anyone destroy his temple. Well, they just built it, and apparently he's willing to let them rob it. Right? There's that long prayer by Solomon where he's trying to sort of attach God permanently to the temple and connect him to it. Say, you just stay here in this house I built for you. Right? Well, we see how well that works. Right? Because remember what God said to Solomon after that. He said, I will come and dwell in this temple if right? You follow all the ways. Well, they haven't. Right? And so to him, this temple is just another building. With just some more gold stuff in it. Now the other interesting thing to note is what isn't mentioned here is the Ark of the Covenant. Okay. Talked about last time the Ethiopian tradition. According to the Ethiopian tradition, okay, the son of the Queen of Sheba and Solomon had already made off with it. Right? Had already taken it and taken it to Ethiopia. Okay. Raiders of the Lost Ark was operating under the assumption that Shoshak took it. That's why they were in Egypt looking for it. Right? It's the idea that here at this point, Shoshak took it. But notice it's not mentioned here. It says it took everything in the temple, but the other times the Ark of the Covenant was taken, that was a big deal. Remember?
Yeah.
The Philistines took it when it was captured. That was a big deal. Here there's no mention of the Ark of the Covenant.
Wasn't there.
So
it would surely be mentioned if it had that much power, wouldn't it? I mean, the Israelites.
Well, that's it. So
we don't
if you want to believe the Ethiopian tradition.
So we don't hear any more about the Ark of the Covenant ever again.
Not physically, no.
Okay, it's
not the physical object.
At this point in time, it's gone.
Gone.
Okay.
Maybe in Ethiopia. Maybe. Maybe in Egypt, maybe neither place. Maybe hidden somewhere, I don't know. But it's... Okay, so verse 27. So King Rehoboam made bronze shields to replace them. You can already tell how much his wealth has declined.
Yeah.
Compared to his father, right? All the gold shields get taken, so he gets bronze ones to replace them. Okay. And assigned these to the commanders of the guard on duty at the entrance to the palace. Whenever the king went to the Lord's temple, the guards bore the shields, and afterwards they returned them to the guard room. So to make sure they don't get stolen again, they just bring them out when the king's going to the temple, and then they go and they hide them in the room. Okay. Very different picture of how Rehoboam is operating from the way his father operated. All the opulence and everything of his father, the reputation... All this, Rehoboam sneaking around with his bronze shield now. It's fallen off fast. Verse 29, as for the other events of Rehoboam's reign and all he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? There was continual warfare between Rehoboam and Jeroboam, and Rehoboam rested with his fathers and was buried with them in the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah, she was an Ammonite, and Abijah, his son, succeeded him as king.
Yes, he had a son with the same name as Jeroboam's son before he... Except he didn't die. And so Abijah... Abijah becomes the new king. Okay.
Chapter 15, verse 1. In the 18th year of the reign of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, Abijah became king of Judah. He reigned in Jerusalem 3 years. His mother's name was Maacah, daughter of... Now, what name does yours...
Absalom? Yeah, that's... It's daughter of Absalom. Okay. So, his mother... is, and again, the importance of his mother being named, she's now the queen mother. So his mother is the granddaughter of David, right? Because Absalom is David's son. Okay. His father is the grandson of David, but through two different mothers. Okay? So, his parents were half brother and sister, is what I'm getting at. So, these huge number of wives and the polygamy problems we talked about, they aren't over yet.
No, you just said
okay,
that.
We're four generations later. And there's still this weird interbreeding and intermarrying going on. Okay, the kind of stuff that caused David's house to have the big downfall in the first place. Okay.
So verse 3, he committed all the sins his father had done before him. His heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his forefather had been. Nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, by raising up a son to succeed him and by making Jerusalem strong. For David had done what was right in the eyes of the Lord and had not failed to keep any of the Lord's command all the days of his life, except in the case of Uriah the Hittite.
Here we have that footnote. But again, remember, David repented, he sought forgiveness, and God's law includes repentance. Includes forgiveness of sins.
Okay.
So, Abijah's no good either. But because of his promise to David, he made the promise to David. He said, David, if you walk in all my ways, then I'll make sure that one of your descendants rules on the throne forever. And so because of that promise, because David did it, God keeps Abijah on the throne and he keeps Abijah a son.
There was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam throughout Abijah's lifetime, meaning between the two kingdoms. As for the other events of Abijah's reign and all he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? There was war between Abijah and Jeroboam, and Abijah rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, and Asa his son succeeded him as king. Okay, and so Asa is going to become king in the 20th year.
Meaning Abijah was king for all of 2 years.
Okay. Because he becomes king in the 18th year of Jeroboam.
His son becomes king in the 20th year of Jeroboam.
Okay.
And again, he may have done all kinds of amazing kingly things, but the only thing that's important to God is the fact that he was disobedient, he was even worse than Rehoboam. And he did evil. There's other things you could read about in the history books.
So in the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa became king of Judah. And he reigned in Jerusalem 41 years. His grandmother's name was Maacah, daughter of Absalom. So he reigns 41 years, 1 year more than Solomon. Notice it says his grandmother's name. Why? Well, she isn't dead yet. He may have only ruled for 2 years, but she's still
alive.
She's still alive. She's still functioning as the queen mother, at least when he takes the throne. But now in verse 11, Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his father David had done. So finally, finally, we've got somebody on the right track. And you notice
41 years.
The number, the difference. Okay. He expelled the male shrine prostitutes from the land and got rid of all the idols his fathers had made. He even deposed his grandmother Maacah from her position as queen mother because she had made a repulsive Asherah pole. Okay, so she's participating in this too, so he deposes her. Okay. He deposes her, presumably puts his mother. Asa cut the pole down and burned it in the Kidron Valley. Although he did not remove the high places, Asa's heart was fully committed to the Lord all his life. He brought into the temple of the Lord the silver and gold and the articles that he and his father had dedicated. There was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, throughout their reigns. Baasha, king of Israel, went up against Judah and fortified Ramah to prevent anyone from leaving or entering the territory of Asa, king of Judah. Asa then took all the silver and gold that was left in the treasuries of the Lord's temple and of his own palace. He entrusted it to his officials and sent them to Ben-Hadad, son of Tabrimon, the son of Hezion, the king of Aram, who was ruling in Damascus. "Let there be a treaty between me and you," he said, "as there was between my father and your father. See, I am sending you a gift of silver and gold. Now break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so he will withdraw from me." Okay, so Baasha, who we'll find out about in a minute, is king of Israel. He comes and he attacks Judah, besieges Jerusalem. Okay, so Asa gets in touch with Ben-Hadad. Again, as far as I know, not related to any of the Hadads we know. Who is the king of the Arameans, meaning the Syrians. Right? You can see way up in the top right corner of the map, Damascus there. In Aram. And he sends him a bunch of gold and silver as a gift, and says, "Hey, remember the treaty you had with my forefathers? Come help me out. Come help me out with Baasha." Ben-Hadad agreed with King Asa and sent the commanders of his forces against the towns of Israel. He conquered Ejon, Dan, Abel-Beth-Maacah, and all Kinnereth, in addition to Naphtali. When Baasha heard this, he stopped building Ramah and withdrew to Tirzah. Okay, so looking at our map, right, Ben-Hadad up in Damascus gets this letter and says, "Hey, can you help me out?" Now, he doesn't come down and attack down by Jerusalem, right, to lift the siege. Okay, his way of helping out is he goes and he attacks these northern towns in Israel, right? He attacks Dan. He attacks down there, see Kinnereth there by the Sea of Galilee. He attacks that whole area of Galilee and conquers that for himself. So he's got kind of a dual motive. He's sort of helping out King Asa. On the other hand, he also just got word that Baasha's whole army is down here, meaning he can attack up here. He has an opening.
And enlarge his territory.
Right. So Baasha gets word of this, that he's being attacked in the north, and so he has to
go.
Pull back and retreat with his army. Yeah. So then King Asa issued an order to all Judah. No one was exempt, and they carried away from Ramah the stones and timber Baasha had been using there. With them, King Asa built up Geba and Benjamin and also Mizpah. You can see these are, if you look right along the border, these are border towns. Baasha had been building up this town Ramah into a fortified city on the border. When he has to pull back, Asa has all his men run in and steal all the building supplies and bring them back across the border and use them to fortify his own cities. Here you see Mizpah there in Geba, and he reinforces all those cities to prevent himself from being invaded again, is the idea. Now these cities are going to be fortified with military so that if Israel decides to attack again, they'll have a more difficult time. As for all the other events of Asa's reign, all his achievements, all he did in the cities he built, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? In his old age, however, his feet became diseased. Then Asa rested with his fathers and was buried with them in the city of his father David. And Jehoshaphat, his son, succeeded him as king. So he's followed by Jehoshaphat. Okay, so he has a nice long reign. And again, built all kinds of cities. Read the history books for that stuff. What's important to God is that he followed, he was obedient, he followed his commands, he followed his ways. He got rid of this pagan worship. He got rid of the members of his own family who are participating in the pagan worship. So now we're going to go back to Israel. We're going to get caught up. Find out who this Baasha guy was anyway. So Nadab, son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah, and he reigned over Israel for 2 years. So, just a guess. What kind of guy do you think
not so
our friend Nadab was? He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, walking in the ways of his father and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit. Baasha, son of Ahijah of the house of Issachar, plotted against him. And he struck him down at Gibbethon, a Philistine town, while Nadab and all Israel were besieging it. Baasha killed Nadab in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and succeeded him as king. Okay, so our friend Baasha here decides, who's from the tribe of Issachar, decides he wants to be king. Okay. And he decides that the way to do that is to assassinate Nadab. And so he waits until Nadab and his army are at war, and they're besieging the city. And in the midst of that, he goes in from behind and assassinates him. So now Baasha is going to set himself up as king. In verse 29, as soon as he began to reign, he killed Jeroboam's whole family. He did not leave Jeroboam anyone that breathed, but destroyed them all, according to the word of the Lord given through his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. Because of the sins Jeroboam had committed and had caused Israel to commit, and because he provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger. As for the other events of Nadab's reign and all he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? There was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, throughout their reigns. In the third year of Asa, king of Israel, Baasha, son of Ahijah, became king of all Israel in Tirzah, and he reigned 24 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, walking in the ways of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit. Okay, so Baasha's going to end up getting 24. But he, once he sets himself up as king, who are the obvious people who are going to come after him now that he's assassinated? Right, the other sons of Jeroboam, who all have a claim to be king. So he goes and wipes out everyone related to Jeroboam off the face of the earth to make sure there's nobody else who can come up with a claim to be king of Israel. Okay. So chapter 16, verse 1. Then the word of the Lord came to Jehu, son of Hanai, against Baasha. I lifted you up from the dust and made you leader of my people Israel. But you walked in the ways of Jeroboam and caused my people Israel to sin and to provoke me to anger by their sins. So I'm about to consume Baasha and his house, and I'll make your house like that of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. Dogs will eat those belonging to Baasha who die in the city, and the birds of the air will feed on those who die in the country. As for the other events of Baasha's reign, what he did and his achievements, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? Baasha rested with his fathers and was buried in Tirzah, and Elah, his son, succeeded him as king. Yeah. So God comes to him and says, you're just as bad as Jeroboam. He said, well, first of all, he says, look, I made you king. It might look like Baasha made himself king by going and killing all these people. But remember, it was God's judgment against Jeroboam.
Baasha was just the one who happened to carry it out. He said, I made you king. You're just as evil as Jeroboam, and so now you're going to suffer the same fate Jeroboam did. Okay. And so his son is Elah.
Verse 7, moreover, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Jehu, son of Hanani, to Baasha in his house because of all the evil he had done in the eyes of the Lord, provoking him to anger by the things he did, and becoming like the house of Jeroboam, and also because he destroyed it. Now that's interesting, that last note. He did all the things, his house did all the things that the house of Jeroboam did. Right? And so God's judging him. And he destroyed the house of Jeroboam. So God's judging him. Remember, God said Jeroboam was going to get wiped out. Right? That was God's judgment. That his whole family was going to get wiped out. Does that make it morally right for Baasha then to come in and take it upon himself to do it?
No.
This is,
we have to remember this when we get into the New Testament. You know, when Christ says, temptations are bound to come, but woe to him through whom they come. Right? Things are going to happen in our lives. We're going to be tempted. People are going to put stumbling blocks in our path. Right? It's going to happen. We know it's going to happen. Okay? But Jesus is saying, don't be the person through whom they happen. And of course, the ultimate case of this is Judas. Right? Jesus predicted all the way from the beginning he was going to be betrayed. Someone was going to betray him. It was going to happen. Okay? That doesn't let Judas off the hook for being the one to go and do it. Okay? So, Baasha, again, God didn't come to Baasha and say, my judgment is against Jeroboam, therefore I have picked you, Baasha. Go and
kill him.
Nothing of the kind. He takes it upon himself. Okay. And this is part of that going all the way back to what we saw in the law, Deuteronomy, with how precious the blood of human beings is to God, where he's going to demand an account for every human being. And he's going to demand an account for all of the blood spilled. It isn't something God's going to let go. Regardless of who it was that got killed, and how justified it was, or may seem.
So verse 8, in the 26th year of Asa king of Judah, Elah son of Baasha became king of Israel, and he reigned in Tirzah 2 years. Zimri, one of his officials, who had command of half his chariots, plotted against him. Elah was in Tirzah at the time, getting drunk in the home of Arza, the man in charge of the palace at Tirzah. Zimri came in, struck him down, and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah. Then he succeeded him as king.
So what happens to Baasha's line looks a whole lot like what happened to Jeroboam's line. Right? And this Zimri becomes king. Now notice also, over here, remember, David kept his covenant, his agreement with God. And so we're still dealing with descendants of David. Over here, we're on our third dynasty because of assassination. Okay, Zimri is in no way related to Jeroboam. Neither was Baasha, and Zimri's not related to Baasha.
Verse 11, as we might expect, as soon as he began to reign and was seated on the throne, he killed off Baasha's whole family. He did not spare a single male, whether relative or friend. So Zimri destroyed the whole family of Baasha in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken against Baasha through the prophet Jehu. Because of all the sins Baasha and his son Elah had committed and had caused Israel to commit, so that they provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their worthless idols. As for the other events of Elah's reign and all he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? In the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, Zimri reigned in Tirzah 7 days.
That was short.
One week.
He didn't last long at all.
The army was encamped near Gibbethon, a Philistine town. When the Israelites in the camp heard that Zimri had plotted against the king and murdered him, they proclaimed Omri, the commander of the army, king over Israel that very day there in the camp. Then Omri and all the Israelites with him withdrew from Gibbethon and laid siege to Tirzah. When Zimri saw that the city was taken, he went into the citadel of the royal palace and set the palace on fire around him. So he died because of the sins he had committed, doing evil in the eyes of the Lord and walking in the ways of Jeroboam, and in the sin he had committed and had caused Israel to commit. As for the other events of Zimri's reign, all 1 week of it, and the rebellion he carried out, are they not written in the books of the annals of the kings of Israel? Okay, so they hear that Zimri's wiped out the house of Baasha and made himself king, and the military decides, we don't like him. We like Omri, who's the commander of the military. Let's make him king instead. So Israel's own military attacks its own capital to set up Omri as king, and Zimri runs into the palace, locks it up, and sets it on fire to commit suicide. And take the palace with him, just, I guess, out of spite.
Not that song.
No, this is the palace that Jeroboam built. Jeroboam was in Israel. Okay, so now we're on our fourth
king.
Fourth dynasty. Okay, our sixth king or fourth dynasty in Israel. Then the people of Israel were split into two factions. Half supported Tibni, son of Ginath, for king, and the other half supported Omri. But Omri's followers proved stronger than those of Tibni, son of Ginath. So Tibni died and Omri became king. Now there's a subtle turn of phrase there.
He died.
Omri's followers were stronger than Tibni's followers, and so Tibni died. With the result that Tibni was dead. Okay? So there was a brief civil war, is the idea. A very brief civil war here. And Omri's followers killed the other potential claimant to the throne, and Omri becomes king. In the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, Omri became king of Israel. And he reigned 12 years, six of them in Tirzah. He bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents of silver and built a city on the hill, calling it Samaria, after Shemer, the name of the former owner of the hill. But Omri did evil in the eyes of the Lord and sinned more than all those before him. He walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and in his sin, which he had caused Israel to commit, so that they provoked the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their worthless idols. As for the other events of Omri's reign, what he did and the things he achieved, are they not written in the books of the annals of the kings of Israel? Omri rested with his fathers and was buried in Samaria, and Ahab his son succeeded him as king. Yeah. So Omri ends up reigning for 12 years. Okay. What are we told about him that he did? Well, we're told how he became king. We're told that he moved the capital, right? The capital had been in Tirzah, probably because Zimri went and burned the palace down. Omri goes and buys this hill, Shemer, and builds the capital city of Samaria. Samaria is going to become very important. The Samaritans that we run into in the New Testament are from Samaria. So this is where Samaria comes from this city, this new capital that gets built by Omri. And we're told he was really wicked. Okay. This is the king I was referring to before, Omri. Okay. From the time he reigns until the time the king of Israel ceases to exist, every other nation in the world, in all the writings we have discovered archaeologically, refers to Israel not as Israel, but as the house of Omri. Okay.
When there are descendants, eventually they're not even his descendants who are the kings, but they're still calling it the house of Omri. Or the house Omri built.
Because he built the house on there.
Well, he built the capital and he expanded the kingdom. He ruled over the second biggest kingdom of any of these guys after Solomon. He won these wars. He engaged in all kinds of diplomacy. We're going to see he married off his son to a daughter of one of the Phoenician kings. Okay, he had a strategic trade alliance with the Phoenicians. For the perspective of history, Omri is the greatest king either of these kingdoms ever had. Okay, in terms of archaeology, in terms of reading the writings of these other kingdoms, if you read anything except the Bible, right? Omri is it. And like I said, we've got one mention of David archaeologically. It's on a pottery shard that refers to the whole kingdom before it split as the house of David. One. And people are arguing about that. Whether it really says David. Omri's every place. Okay. And what do we get about him in Scripture? From God's point of view. What's Omri? He moved the capital and he was evil. That's it. That's it. And it's important to take note of in terms of who and what is significant as far as God is concerned. Because it's usually not the same people who are significant in terms of
history.
In terms of history and us. You know. It may very well be that there are monks who we will never see or hear of on Mount Athos or in caves somewhere. Or just people who we don't know are saints living quiet lives, you know, in Omaha, Nebraska, and and the middle of nowhere village in Russia, you know, who are right now the most significant people in the world to God. And we're not going to see them on E. Right? We're not going to see them on the cover of People magazine. Right? Nobody's taking pictures of them. Nobody's asking them their opinions about world peace. Right? We don't care about them. We don't care about them. But they're the people who are close to God right now. And who, if scriptures were being written today, who the stories would be about. Okay? God's point of view is very different than ours. Very different than ours. All the things that sort of dazzle us about power and wealth and beauty and all these things, as we see from the case of Omri, God could really care less. He's looking at people's hearts. Now, when he looked at Omri's heart, there wasn't much there to look at. So, this is a case where what the Bible doesn't say is very important. Not so much what it says, but how little it says. And we're going to come back to his son Ahab. We're going to come back to his son Ahab.
About the whale?
No.
Okay. That's true.
You're thinking of Ahab and Moby Dick. Captain Ahab, who is named after this Ahab, but who is not the same person. This is Ahab of Ahab and Jezebel.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So verse 29, in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel, and he reigned in Samaria over Israel for 22 years. So Ahab, 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. So he did all the stuff Jeroboam did when he was just warming up. Right? Like before 8 a.m., he did all the stuff Jeroboam used to do. But he also married Jezebel, daughter of Etbaal, king of the Sidonians,
and began to serve Baal and worship him. Okay, her dad's name ought to be a tip-off. That this guy's a pagan, right? And he starts worshiping Baal with her. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. In Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son Abiram. And he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son Segub, in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua son of Nun. Last little bit is parenthetical. Remember, there was that prophecy back in Joshua. You probably don't remember because it was kind of a footnote there. When Jericho was destroyed, that if anyone tried to rebuild it, he would lose one son at the beginning and another son at the end of the building. Well, that finally happens here during Ahab's reign. You can see Jericho down there at the very south end of Israel. Okay. That's yet another example during Ahab's reign of someone deciding, you know, oh, who cares what God said about it? I'm going to go rebuild it. And paying the price. So Ahab definitely does Solomon one better. He goes and builds a big temple to Baal in the new capital that his father built for Israel. Now, a good chunk, further illustration of what I was just saying earlier about Omri, a good chunk of the rest of 1 Kings is going to take place while Ahab is reigning. It's going to take place during this 22 years. We've been moving pretty quick, right, through all these kings. It's going to take place while Ahab's alive. Here's the thing. It's not going to be about Ahab. Ahab's going to be, he's going to be in it. He's going to show up as a supporting cast member, right? But the story is going to be about the prophet Elijah, who we're about to meet. Okay. So, further illustration of my point, the person who's important to God in Israel right now is this fellow named Elijah, the Tishbite. Okay? This is the person who's important to God right now. This is the person who's closest to God. Ahab, yeah, he's got his big new Baal temple. Yeah, he's got his nice new capital, but you can read about him in the history books. He was wicked. Okay. So we'll do chapter 17 here, and then we'll leave off for our break. Chapter 17, verse 1. Now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." Okay. So, this town, by the way, Tishbe, we don't hear about it anywhere else. And the word means settlement. Okay. So the idea is he's from some backwater village somewhere. He's not from some important place. Okay. He's not from some important. And he just sort of appears now. This prophet just sort of appears. You can't really tell in the English it's translated into. Okay. But in the original, Elijah is, shall we say, not very verbose. Okay. He's not very eloquent. Okay. The what he says here is the equivalent in modern dialect of "ain't gonna rain no more." Right? He basically comes in front of the king and says, "Ain't gonna rain no more. Unless I say so." And he walks out. Okay? So, to give you an idea, that comes through a lot better than the original. But in terms of his character. Now, Elijah is going to be very important. He's also known as St. Elias. Elias is the Greek form that his name takes. He's in two stained glass windows and an icon on our iconostasis. Okay, we're going to see the events in those. Well, one of the stained glass windows is the transfiguration of Jesus. So it's going to be a while before we get to that one. But we're going to see the others here pretty soon as we read about his life. But he's a very important figure in terms of Old Testament figures, in terms of the worship of the Orthodox Church. St. Elias is, after Moses, probably the most prominent Old Testament figure who you're going to see in iconography and represented. And he's sort of, in the way that Moses represents the law
Elijah is going to represent the prophets. And we're going to talk as we go more about Elijah and his connections to St. John the Forerunner, St. John the Baptist, and his role in prophecy and that kind of thing as we go. But for now, here he is from some backwater place, walks in front of the king, ain't going to rain no more unless I say so, turns around.
Hits the door.
Okay. So, verse 2, then the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kereth ravine east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I have ordered the ravens to feed you there. So he did what the Lord had told him. He went to the Kereth ravine east of Jordan and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. Okay. This is, if you're in our church, second stained glass window. On the left-hand side, on the north side. First one's Moses. Second one is St. Elias or Elijah. And you'll see there are birds coming in, bringing him bread and meat. And he's sitting next to a brook. That's this right here. Now, I do have to note, because you may watch a History Channel documentary or on another, but there are people who are trying to argue, that it does not say ravens here, but that it says Arabs here, because the word is very similar in Hebrew and Aramaic. So they want to say there were Arabs who brought him meat and bread in the morning and meat and bread in the evening, to try to not have the miraculous birds bringing things. Now I submit two things. Number one, that makes less sense. Right.
Who was the Arabs?
Who were the Arabs? How did they know he was there? And why were they bringing him food? Right.
I don't wonder.
So it doesn't really, if your problem with this text is that there's birds bringing him food and it's a miracle, I don't see how having magical Arabs show up with food like a genie out of a lamp or something makes it less miraculous or less. I don't see how that really gets you out of the dilemma. So, but needless to say, you may see someone say that, in which case you can chuckle again. Okay, so the idea is after he makes this pronouncement to Ahab, he goes and hides out by this brook. He's got water, he's got food. God's taking care of him. Okay. He's living in the wilderness. Verse 7, sometime later the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. Because what he prophesied had come true, it hadn't rained. So eventually the brook dries up. Then the word of the Lord came to him, go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I have commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food. So he went to Zarephath. Okay, now if you get out your map. Okay. He was down here. You can see where Samaria is sort of smack in the middle of Israel. Okay? If you go sort of straight east from there by the Jordan, that's where the Kereth Ravine was. Okay? Where he was hiding out. But now if you go all the way up into Phoenicia, between Tyre and Sidon, you can see where Zarephath is. So Zarephath is not an Israelite city or a Judahite city. It's a Phoenician city up on the coast. Okay. So God is sending him, that's quite a trip, and he's sending him out of Israel.
And would they be hunting him at this time?
Well, we're gonna find out. But so he's heading up there, okay. So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink? As she was going to get it, he called, and bring me please a piece of bread. As surely as the Lord your God lives, she replied, I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. That's kind of a depressing outlook. Right? Okay, but obviously now if it hasn't rained, clearly it hasn't, not only has it not rained over Israel, it hasn't rained over this whole area. Right? There's some kind of famine going on. And she's a widow. We've talked about the status of widows in these cultures at that time. I mean, you're basically begging for food. You had no legal rights. You had no way to make a living. She's got this son who she's trying to support. She's like, he comes and asks her for food. You know, he's a traveler. She says, love to, but all I've got is, you know, I've got enough to maybe make one little cake to share with my son. We're going to eat that. And then I guess we're just going to starve to death because that's it. That's it. I'm out here collecting sticks so I can try and cook it. Also notice, however, how she greets him. She's a Phoenician. Right? She's not an Israelite. She can tell he is. That's where he's from. And she says, as surely as the Lord, as Yahweh your God lives, I don't have anything. Okay? So she knows who Yahweh is. I don't know how many of these folks right now know who Yahweh is. Okay? But this Phoenician widow up here knows who Yahweh is. Verse 13, Elijah said to her, don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. But first make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me. And then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land. She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. Okay. So Elijah says, don't worry about it. Go ahead, make me some food first. Make some for yourself, make some for your son, and you'll see it won't run out. And lo and behold, it doesn't. But notice that she goes immediately and does what he says. So not only does she know who Yahweh is, but she believes that when Yahweh makes a promise, it's true. And she does what Yahweh is telling her to do. Compared to... And Jesus makes this point. He says, when Elijah was in Israel, were there no widows in Israel that he could have gone to?
Yeah.
The people? Of course there were widows. There were widows all over the place. Were there any of them with faith?
None.
Maybe not. Right? But there's one here. There's one here in Phoenicia.
And basically, away from Israel, there's
a a Gentile.
Yeah, a Hittite.
Okay, this Phoenician. So, Ahab is setting up his nice temple for the god of Phoenicia. For his wife. Meanwhile, the Phoenician widow is the only one around in this famine who really has faith in
God.
In Yahweh. That's the contrast here. And so because she has that faith, famine or no famine, she's fine. God provides for her. The same way he provided for Elijah when he was hiding down at the brook. Verse 17, sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, what do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son? So her son died. Now remember, widow.
Yeah.
Right? No legal right, no nothing. What's her one hope?
Her son.
That her son could grow up, right? And take care of her and provide for her and represent her, right? This is her one hope in life, and now he dies. Right? But notice, even though she's angry at Elijah, did you come here to remind me of my sin and kill my son?
Don't blame God.
She said she sees this horrible thing happen to me. It must be because I'm so sinful. Right? This horrible thing has fallen upon me. It must be because I'm so sinful. My family must now be wiped out the way Jeroboam's was because I'm so wicked. So, not only do we have someone who worships Yahweh here, we have someone who's actually showing repentance. Right? Remember Jeroboam? We have this prophecy against him. The altar splits in front of him. His arm withers up. Does he repent? Does he say, I've been wicked?
No.
This woman is repentant. Verse 19, give me your son, Elijah replied. He took him from her arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. Then he cried out to the Lord, O Lord my God, have you brought tragedy also upon this widow I am staying with by causing her son to die? Then he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried to the Lord, O Lord my God, let this boy's life return to him. The Lord heard Elijah's cry and the boy's life returned to him and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, look, your son is alive. Then the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth. So this is our first example anywhere in the Bible of someone being raised from the dead. Note. Okay? This is one of the reasons why Elijah is going to be considered so important. Right, this is the miracle of all miracles. Right, he was dead, now he's alive. Notice also that he stretches out on him three times. Okay. So, God restores life, not just to the son, but really to the widow as well. Right, her hope is now restored. Right, her hope of future, her legacy is restored. But now, what does that mean? What does that mean in terms of the bigger picture here?
That a bunch of other people better start doing like that lady.
Well, no. A whole bunch of people are dead.
Yeah.
Or as good as. Okay. They've turned their back on God. They've come under this curse. Right? They're dying horrible. Bloody death assassinations in Israel. Right? They're not following the Lord in Judah either, by and large, other than Asa. Right? But if God can bring this dead boy back to life, he could definitely restore Israel. He could definitely restore Judah. If what? If they do what the woman did and they repent. If they'll turn around and repent, he'll restore them. He hasn't cut them off completely. Story's not over yet. So, this little story, this isn't just a little vignette about this Phoenician widow that's stuck in here. It's important that we see these contrasts with what's going on in the rest of Israel. On the one hand, how condemning is it that these people to whom God revealed himself and who he's given so much and spoken so much are like this, and this woman up in Phoenicia believes in him and worships him and obeys him and repents of her sins. On the other hand, if she's not too far gone, they're not too far gone. If her dead son isn't too far gone, they're not too far gone. So, we see both pieces here. We see the level of God's judgment against them with the famine, but we see his willingness to preserve them and restore them if they'll turn from what they're doing and repent. So I think that's probably the best place to leave off now. Even though we've just got introduced to Elijah, there's a lot more Elijah to come. But so we'll pick up, it's going to be in 3 weeks, if I'm right, because next week we've got Symphony Sunday. Week after that, church picnic. So week after that, we'll come back and pick up at chapter 18 and get into it. Probably that night, we'll probably get through the rest of 1 Kings / 3 Kingdoms, the rest of the Elijah story. So thank you everybody for coming. Yes, holiday weekend.